All right, welcome to the Canadian Orange Podcast. This is a place for Canadians to have conversations about how we restore freedom in Canada by adopting a sound money standard. Orange is the color of freedom. My name is Nick. I'm talking to Lucas today. Current block height is 928,323. Hash rate is sitting at 1,115 exahashes per second. Let's get into it. So we're going to talk about... We're going to talk about what actually happens when we fix the money. So where do you want to start with that? What's been on your mind? Where do we want to go first?
It's such a big question. I was thinking about it and I think it's, yeah, I just have to hash it out with you because
that's why we're here.
It's like you basically have this like horizon you can't see over, where it's been broken for as long as we've been alive, and it's been basically as long as anyone's been alive. It's been broken in different ways and breaking more and more as time goes on. And it's like kind of like what we were talking about before the show, like the outlook of our grandparents. It's like it's not, they are kind of leaving the world right now in a state where they feel like things are getting worse, which is what a terrible, it's just such an awful way to feel about the world. I'm sure some of them are optimistic and there's varying levels of despair, but I guess it's just like sometimes I think I tend towards like a pessimistic view with like a lot of hope, I guess, is kind of my orientation towards this. So it's hard for me to actually
a hopeful
look
pessimist.
To it's also like the most miserable way to be in the world, I guess.
No, you could be a hopeless pessimist. That would be worse.
That's true. Yeah. I don't know what the matrix there looks like, but so yeah, it's about, I guess, identifying the way that certain things change. We've spoken about various things like offline, like healthcare and the military and your personal life when you adopt a sound money standard, how things can change. And it's a really interesting point, but like things get generally better. But specifically, it's hard to even imagine what it can be, like the potential for it can be, you know.
I don't
like
think
what
it's
are
hard.
your thoughts about
it? I imagine
okay yeah
it a lot.
Okay, good, good.
I
we got
spend
the we
most
got the optimist in the room.
Yeah, I think in general I'm very hopeful, and I am a realist, but I am an optimist. I'm not a naive optimist that thinks we're going to get this utopia that's full of flowers and great smells, and I'm not a naive optimist. I like to think I'm a realist. Sometimes I have to adjust. But I think if we really zoom out, you're right. I think a lot of things get better. But I think the element that I think most about that I think can be applied to all the different subordinate areas of change that will happen, all the different sort of derivative changes that happen when you change the money, is this idea that I remember reading Saifedean in the Bitcoin Times wrote something. He said, the currency that people use is the control knob for their time preference. So if you use hard money, that grinds your time preference lower, where you care more about the future because you have something to care about in future. And if in high time preference money, easy money, fiat currency, elevates people's high time preference. So makes them more oriented towards instant gratification, right? The money's gonna be less worth less tomorrow than it is today. So I'm incentivized just to care more about today than tomorrow, right? When you invert that, you change people's time preference. And I think lowering one's time preference affects your health. It affects people's desire to have families. High time preference is watch porn, don't invest in any long-term relationship, have flighting romance, promiscuous sex. Like that's high time preference. That is literally the highest time preference. The lowest time preference is to build a generation, a family lineage of kids and grandkids And what is the verse in the Bible? It says, "Go forth and prosper and multiply," or something like that. I should know that one. That's low
Yeah,
time prayer.
I don't know. Yeah.
And even entrepreneurship and building, entrepreneurship. You want to build a business that's going to function well long term. That's super low time preference. You want to try and, preserve your wealth. If you're a high time preference, you're investing in risk, super speculative, risky meme stocks. If you're low time preference, you're saving. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, changing the money changes the fundamental incentive, which is the time preference orientation that it nudges in everyone that lives in society. That affects people's health. That affects the propensity to have a family. That affects people's willingness to start a business and what the threshold is for a business that's worth creating. Everything changes because the fundamental incentives have changed. And I think the whole tagline of Orange, Canadian Orange Party, Canadian Orange Podcast, is fix the money, fix Canada. And I think a lot of people that understand how profound sound money is and how profound Bitcoin is understand that at a theoretical or maybe even just a metaphorical sense, right? But if you can't actually explain what that looks like in true reality or what it could look like, people actually can't imagine a future that allows them to really feel a gravitation towards achieving it. Right? It's like, that's this thing. People say it. I might even know it's true. I can't imagine what that looks like. And so I kind of don't really believe it's possible because I can't even imagine what it looks like. It's like, you got to be able to imagine something before it becomes reality. So I think with health, when people adopt sound money, it lowers their time preference. And I think health is a low time preference endeavor. So I think the first thing, maybe the most important thing it changes is it improves everyone's health. Because now, if their time's not being stolen, they have time to take care of themselves or to start learning how to take care of themselves. Let's start there.
Yeah, I agree. I think like we talk kind of a lot about incentives. So having sound money, being able to save your time and energy in money that isn't eroded over the course of time, it essentially makes it so that you get richer over time, and that changes your priorities to not spend as much now. If my money's just going to burn up, I'm just going to like party now, everyone dies one day. And there's this kind of interesting paradox when, so I view this like part of the answer to the question, how does sound money change? Like if we're thinking on a national political level, it's hard to kind of map that onto an entire, basically a civilization, right? Like Canada as a country. But it's pretty easy to map it on in your own life. And like you and I have met people whose lives have just been changed by switching to a sound money standard. And initially they typically come in because, oh, Bitcoin or gold is ripping, it's like this, oh, let's get on this train and see what happens. They learn more. As they learn more about how the time is being used, how they can use their time better, and the preciousness of their time, because I work now and that work becomes more valuable over time. It's a very strange idea. Your ability to buy a house because of what you did 5 years ago increases over time. It's so hard to wrap your head around, and this changes people's lives on an individual level in a very interesting way. And if you, that's why it's so hard for me to map this on, because it's an incredibly optimistic view. What happens when an entire, when the kind of control architecture of your country develops a low time preference? Do you think that they're more likely to kind of tighten their grip around you and control what you're doing, what you're spending your money on? Or is there this like, it's like, no, we're prospering. Like we're prospering more and more the more that Canadians do work. Everyone is rewarded in this way, and everyone is rewarded for everyone's work. And that's something that's like we kind of, I kind of like almost tongue in cheek said last episode, like, this is for communists. Like, good sound money is for communists. It's for libertarians. It's for everyone in between. It's for anarchists. It's for everyone, because it like the thing you're trying to accomplish with your and my cockamamie political ideas is accomplished by fixing the money, and you don't have to force anyone to do anything. It
I
aligns the
love that.
incentives. And man,
Yeah.
it's like it
Rules without
th when
rules.
this
It
light
is
bulb
the
goes up,
embodiment of it.
and yeah, it's like you can't steal it from me, so you don't even have to try. And when I work, you get richer. Who's gonna come kick in my door when that's the case? I mean, it's not gonna be we still have our like kind of animalistic tendencies. It's not gonna be a utopia on Earth. I just think it's going to be so much better, and better every year. That's why we're doing, like, I'm not like, you don't have to twist anyone's arm to advocate for this stuff, because you just see how simple it is. And you just see these people that are like, yeah. I mean, I mentioned the last episode, there's these people who are tied up in these incentives, just making massive amounts of money off of other people, whether they know it or not. I don't know. People closest to the money printer, Cantillon effect, Cantillionaires kind of situation. It's worth looking up if you haven't heard about it. But I think that they change for the better with this. This is good for them too. And maybe that's just my like, yeah, maybe that's just quixotic
I
and
don't disagree. I don't disagree.
starry-eyed, but
I mean, it's our
yeah, man.
perspective. We're entitled to our opinion. I like to think it's a pretty informed opinion, and it's better for everyone, except for people who want to game and steal from other people. And it shouldn't be good for them. Right now, the system is good for them. Unfortunately, it's a system that the fiat system is based on a deception. Therefore, deceit is fundamentally baked into the cake. The most deceptive people end up being able to deceive the most people. It's kind of crazy. But in this system of truth, the most truthful people and capable people end up helping make everything better for everyone else. Right? It's like
I think it's, yeah.
if you want to start a business, you start a business, you generate value for the world, and the whole world benefits from the work that you're doing because it's creating value for them. It's the only reason they're going to buy your thing, product or service. If you don't want to start a business, and all that value generation is basically being baked into this finite amount of money called Bitcoin. If you don't want to start a business, that's totally fine. You cannot even buy the product or service that the guy who did want to start a business made and still benefit from that business because he or she is creating value into the world. That value is being crystallized into these units of money, which there's a finite amount. Therefore, every unit of money that you hold, because you have to give value in the world in some way to earn money too. That's how the world works, not in a fiat system, but in a real truthful system. That's how it works. And your money will be made more valuable by people who you don't know, have never met, and might not even agree with what they're doing, but they're going to make you more wealthy. That's the ultimate incentive aligner. The crazy thing is it's planetary. Like we draw borders. We can talk about things within borders. We're from Canada. We're working on Canada because you have to pick a place to work on, and why not it be the place where you live to make a better life for yourself, and your family, and your kids. But at the end of the day, someone who started a business in Africa or Mexico and put value into the world made every sat you and I and every person that owns Bitcoin more valuable in some way, in some tiny incremental way. And so it's like Jeff Booth says it all the time. It does sound like a trope, but I think when you go deep, when you dig down deep enough, it's true. It's like 8 billion people in service to 8 billion people. That's what Bitcoin is. That's what a truthful monetary system is. Instead of there being, 7.9 billion people in service to 100 million overlords who are capturing the power because they control the money printer. Like, no more of that.
Yeah. It's worth mentioning, like, the current system is the exact opposite. That's what you're saying. It is, and that's Jeff Booth as well. It is the exact opposite of being in service to everyone.
So lowest time preference, which changes investing. One subset of that it changes, I think, is investing. So, and the reason it does that is because it makes saving viable again. In a fiat world, saving is not possible because your money is, your currency is melting. So you must do something with it. You must take on more risk to generate a return, because if you don't do that, it's going to degrade, and it degrades super fast. So the only reason, wild speculation, all the way from like degenerate gambling, but also to like sophisticated investing, there's a spectrum there. People have to take less risk, be less speculative, and frankly, investing becomes optional instead of mandatory. You don't have to buy another house to preserve your money. You don't have to buy stocks. You don't have to buy a bond, whatever. You don't have to take this extra risk to generate more money, because if you just save the money, in the money, just the money itself, it gets more valuable over time. And the crazy thing is, it gets more valuable over time than anything else you can do by taking risk on right now. Right? If you put your money in an S&P 500 index fund, you make 15% a year taking on some risk, because there's a giant recession, you're going to get screwed. All those businesses have their own layers of risk. You have to take on a good amount of risk. Because you took risk on from such a broad swath of companies, you mitigate the acute risk, right? Where like one company fails, well, you own a tiny piece of 499 other of the best companies in the States. But you don't even have to do that anymore. So I think speculation and investing become optional when we have sound money. And the opposite is true right now, where in a fiat world, you have to speculate because saving is impossible. And maybe you're speculating on a house, which you think is maybe it's a safe investment. But the reality is, you take on a lot of risk by owning a house, because you got to rent it out, you got to take care of repairs, you got to pay taxes, you got to maintain the property, like so many things. So I think that's one thing it changes, is when we go to a sound money standard, people can just save. They don't have to invest, they don't have to speculate, they don't have to pay a money manager to tell them what to do with their money. That's crazy. We financialize it so much. Yeah, what are your
Yes,
thoughts on that?
say well, I mean, I'm not even gonna apologize anymore for stealing from Jeff Booth. Just if I do it, just imagine that I know
I
and
think
I'm
you have Jeff's blessing. I think Jeff would
attributing
say,
it to
steal
him.
everything I've said. We need this to go out there. We'll assume your blessing is had, Jeff. If it's not, message us on Noster.
And if I'm wrong, please, but saving your money and money, what an amazing idea. That's what you're describing, is saving your money and money.
Make saving your money and money great again.
Exactly. And I think it's worth diving into everyone's fears. I've met people who own Bitcoin, who own gold, who are very critical of central bankers, who have gone the they've gone 99% of the way, but there is this crucial 1% that is very difficult for people to get through, which is tied to Keynesian economics, which is this idea that everything goes bad when something is deflationary. So if we're talking about, the kind of cryptocurrency realm, they're like, yeah, Bitcoin is great, but we're going to need some other cryptocurrency that's going to act as this sort of this, silver to Bitcoin's gold, whatever, where that's inflationary so that people can invest in things. And there's like this, it's
What's the logic?
weird.
It just sounds like bad
But
thinking.
so it's the fear, but it's the fear that we talked about last time. It's the fear of, I own a house, I have, X hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. If we start deflating, I'm gonna be burnt. Like, this is gonna suck for me.
Sell
And that's the issue. It's a malinvestment. You're
You made a
and
mistake.
it's going to you made a mistake,
Well,
and it's
actually,
like,
I wouldn't even say that. You were deceived. That's maybe better, because frankly, I don't blame the people who bought the house. Part of them has to take some responsibility for the fact that they saw that this is this, they didn't see that this is a wonky, messed up system that is going to fail. So their responsibility is, you didn't look into the system enough, but it's like they were deceived into thinking that was a good thing. But I guess I just want to say, it's like, it's not your fault. But you're going to feel some pain for not researching it enough and being, you know, it's going to be like a fever. This is because I remember you were talking about, we went through that example of young family just bought a house, $400,000 mortgage. Deflation happens in 2 years, their house is worth half as much. They owe $400,000 on a $250,000 house. That is nasty. That's painful. That's frankly not fair, but that is just a consequence. And the flip side of that is like that's like a fever. It sucks, but it's required, and you're going to feel better on the other side of it because you're not going to die and you're not going to be sick forever. And it's like if you are levered with a giant mortgage, you're financially sick right now because you're way underwater. Just because you got good terms and you just have to pay 2 grand a month, it doesn't change the fact that you have a giant debt looming over your head, based on the value of something in a currency that is manipulatable. And part of that manipulation is interest rates artificially set by a central bank. But there's a cost to that, right? It's like, and if one generation of people who own a house have to go through this deflationary event, and I don't think it's going to be acute like in a year, it could be significant. Like people would stop selling houses what they're asking for now, then they start having to ask a little bit less. Like it's a gradual thing. It's not like a tomorrow houses are half price. Although if you don't own a house, that would be a great occurrence, right? And like, who's to say that the people who own the houses deserve to get preferential treatment at the expense of the people who don't own the houses? So there's going to be pain felt, but you said it last time on the last episode. It's like there's no good or bad. There's only trade-offs. Something to that effect. It was a Thomas Sowell quote.
Well, I think the key here too is like this is already happening. Probably fortunately, it's not de the debt isn't denominated in Bitcoin. You have this kind of like fiat BS layer between you and the Bitcoin, but like your house is already being like
His assets already collapsed.
it's already collapsed. What is it in the last 5 years?
Decade,
Years is
99%.
it 99%? And so there's this great incentive to off ramp, and like obviously there's people in Bitcoin and gold, whatever, that are into real estate as well. This is not like I'm not advocating for some huge system-wide collapse or anything, but there's this kind of soft landing available to anyone who sees this coming or who has reservations about using this cheap credit, where it's like, oh, I could just sell my house, use the initial, even if I'm just like in the down payment, the down payment is probably going to be able to buy you a home in cash and what a certain amount of time, like arguably, and not, I'm not saying that's a good solution to this problem at all, but like I think that just on an individual level, we don't need some systemic catastrophe. People can just demonetize their own home
Yep. And it's already
and
happening.
sell it and rent it. Like it is absolutely already happening. So.
And one thing I'll say too is, you know, like I still can imagine, I can still act within the fiat incentive system and want to preserve my own wealth or grow my own wealth within the fiat system, right? I'm incentivized to take on more debt. I'm incentivized, you can do it conservatively, right? But like I'm just thinking of, okay, someone owns a house. The house is worth 600,000 right now. They have a $400,000 mortgage. So they got 200,000 of equity, $600,000 house, $400,000 mortgage. They look forward and they're like, "Ooh, Bitcoin's eating away. I'm looking at the value of my house denominated in sats. It's collapsing. I need to somehow protect myself. I don't really want, I have to live somewhere. I have to have a family somewhere." That person takes a $100,000 loan out using their home, their equity as collateral, buys Bitcoin. That ends up being a hedge to basically say, well, as my home value gets sucked out, gets demonetized by Bitcoin over time, my Bitcoin value is getting energized. And so it's almost like you can hold these two assets. You still have to live somewhere. It's good to own your home. Sucks that fiat is causing a demonetization of your house. And if you own some Bitcoin, you have a hedge against the demonetization, and you actually benefit from the demonetization of your house because your asset, the one asset that you can truly own that the government can't take from you, tax or steal from you right now, or ever, frankly, They just can't. Like you said, if they can't steal it, why bother trying? The return on violence and effort is zero in Bitcoin, which is fundamentally different, both from a peer-to-peer standpoint. Is like someone tries to rob me of a seed phrase. If I don't tell them, they get nothing. Their incentive is to try and harm me a little, or for me to give them some. You know, it changes the return on violence, and it does it with governments too. But if you own a house and you see this coming, buy some Bitcoin, secure it, and then you can offset the losses of your house. That's just kind of, you know, there are ways that if people research sound money and research Bitcoin, study Bitcoin and understand it, they're going to be able to protect themselves from the damage caused in the fiat world with assets they own, because they're going to be able to understand where this is going. And I think at the end of the day, houses returning to their utility value is good for all Canadians. Houses being artificially inflated is good for very few Canadians who are over-levered in debt and may need a reminder that it's not good to take on millions of dollars of debt under this false assumption that the illusion of fiat currency is going to be around forever, because it's not. And the sooner we end it, the better it gets for everyone. Rant over, sorry.
No, yeah. Yeah, it's interesting to think of what happens in the interim if this kind of catches on. I guess just prices fall, people sell. This kind of pain is just like you said, it's this fever kind of occurs over a protracted period or some period of time where people realize this.
The healing will be painful, but it's required.
Yeah. And it's probably, I'd imagine it's gradual. It's not like we're a very small kind of minority of people that believe this stuff. You know, half the people we talk, 95% of the people you talk to probably think you're crazy for imagining this magic internet money can do this or that gold, you know, backed, like they think inflation's good and all that. So it's I think it's going to take time anyway, and it's just going to favor the people that kind of see this happen early, take the quote unquote risk, depending on your point of view. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's already adopting a sound money standard is already happening on an individual level everywhere, even in Canada. I think there is a threshold that needs to be met of number of people who have done that, and a motivation level has to be hit for people wanting to actually make a cultural change instead of just their reality, because they're going to get exposed to fiat degradation outside of their own citadel eventually. Like, you don't want to be the richest guy around 10,000 people struggling to eat, because you can't build walls high enough, and that sucks for everyone except you. And that's really no better. The goal is for it to be really good for everyone. It can be really good for everyone. The switch is incredibly simple, not easy, but simple. Stop creating money. That's it. Just stop debasing people's time by printing more currency. Stop doing that. We don't actually have to do that. It's not mandatory. It's not healthy. It's not fair. It's immoral, literally. It's immoral behavior. It's like, do not steal. That is a really good principle. It's one of the commandments. Thou shalt not steal. Don't steal from people. Inflation is theft. As much as people have been conditioned to thinking it's just a word that describes prices going up every year, which is good, that's a total lie and fraud. And until people realize what is actually happening, like if you go up to anyone on the street and say, "Are you okay if I steal 10% of your stuff next year?" There's not going to be many people that are like, "Sure, here's my address. Here's the key to the door. Make sure you only take 10%." No one would say that. So I think if people actually knew it was happening, they would be a little bit more outraged and a little bit more eager to take some action, especially if the action was a small step. So that inflation pamphlet, the first Canadian Orange Party project is an inflation pamphlet, a two-fold fold-out inflation pamphlet that basically says inflation is theft. You're being stolen from. It's not fair. We can stop it. Here's a canned letter. Send it to your politician, because you should be upset about this. And if enough of us do this, we can actually change. We can get people in politics talking about this. It's fixable. Let's talk about more things that change under a sound money standard. So we We talked the other day about military. You know, what can the Canadian military? Also, even just before we say this, I find it interesting that Canada has more CRA tax collectors than it does active military personnel. Did you know that?
No, I did not know that.
Fact.
That's wild.
So, what that tells me is Canada's not in the business of attacking other countries and robbing other countries. They're in the business of exploiting their citizens. That's the nasty reality of what is actually going on in Canada. So, getting back to the military, what is the purpose of a mil under a sound money standard within a country where you cannot just print money that you don't have? So all the money you have to, I mean, I don't want to be too, I was gonna say, I don't want to be brutally honest here, because it is just honesty. It's like, you can only spend what you steal from people. Or differently, you can only spend what you tax from people. And it's the same thing. And one day we can have the discussion about taxes and theft and that discussion. If you can only spend what you can get from your citizens, you're going to have to ask your citizens to pay for things, or else they're not going to give you their money. So, under a sound money standard, if you're not invading other countries to steal stuff, and if you go meta with that in a Bitcoin world, you can't steal another country's Bitcoin, and that's the only thing of value. So, you wouldn't go and invade a country for their oil, because, I mean, you might. A lot of countries do that. But, in Canada, we already don't invade other countries, right, to steal anything, because we just have a weak military, which I think is a problem. But what is it almost, us talking about that almost made me think of, like, what is the reason, why does a military exist? Let's even wind it back a lot. I'd love to hear your take on this. Why does a military exist? And under a sound money standard where you can't print money that you don't have, what does a military, let's just go straight up Canadian context, not make it too like global or metaphorical. It's like, we're in Canada right now. What is the role of our military, and what does our military look like under a sound money standard? You go first and I'll share thoughts.
Well, it's the Department of National Defense. It's defending your people and resources to the benefit of your people and resources and or and their use of your resources. And that in a fiat standard is corrupted because the incentives are aligned in such a way that the definition of defending your people is it is corrupted in such a like bizarre and disgusting way where if someone doesn't agree with your with using your economic standard your the you as the reserve currency it is in your it becomes like I'm not saying it's this is actually the case but it becomes quote unquote in your country's interest to invade that, to aggress that country and disincentivize other countries who don't trust your fiat standard to go away from it. Also
Basically,
sanctions,
intimidation.
which impover intimidation to like impoverishing people through sanctions, all these things. I don't know if that's clear.
Well, I think the clarity of the military is an organization of people that wields violence to protect Canadians and Canada and Canada's borders. Or resources, like our land, basically, and everything the land contains. And our, the utopian mindset of, oh, we shouldn't even have borders. It's like, in theory, I
Or
agree.
military for some people
Yeah,
some
it's like,
people
in
think they
theory,
shouldn't have a military.
yeah. And that's a slippery slope. I think it's good to have a military. It's good to protect your nation's resources from people who will invade it. It's good to protect your people from people who wish to harm them. I think it's good. And it allows this, the beauty of that, whatever people say about like borders, they're just artificial, they're drawn, it creates wars, all that kind of stuff. The beauty about that is actually you can go to a place that you align most with on culture and I want to go to the place that I'm most free and feel most protected from real nasty people, which there are in the world. And I don't want to have to interact with them. I don't want to feel in danger from them. And so if I'm within the border of this borders of this nation, which I agree with, I voluntarily choose to live there and pay into expenses for my community to make sure I have a good life, my kids have a good life. I think a military is good. And the other thing too is, just like a business should have assets, a family should have assets, right? You want to have savings because when times get hard, you want resources there so that you can eat and have shelter. Take that into a business. You want to have savings in a business because if times get tough and business gets tough, you want to have resources so you can keep paying people and keep doing the work. Let's take nation. As a nation, you want to have savings because if your nation undergoes a tough time, tough circumstances in any way, you want some extra resources to be able to pull from to keep your people alive and to keep things functioning, right? So I think it's good to have resources. It's good to have savings as an individual, a company, or a nation. Canada doesn't have any. Canada has abundant resources from our land, but the fiat virus in Canada has essentially degraded our national wealth to the point where we sold off all the gold that we had. We are the fourth largest gold producer in the world. We have zero gold in our assets. We have no savings. We're just in debt. Like the CFO for our country is terrible, has been terrible for a long time. And they're just products of the incentive of working within a fiat system where it's like, if you can make money out of nowhere, make more of it. Why not spend on whatever you want, even if it's not really valuable? We can make it out of nowhere. So we just got to spin this story that this is for a good cause, and that allows us to spend a bunch more money. With the military, yeah. It's good to have savings. What I was trying to get to is it's good to have savings. The country should have savings. Those resources, those savings, you know, that wealth must be protected. And I think the military's main job is protect the borders, protect the people, protect the wealth of the nation, which is the savings account of the nation. Could be a stockpile of Bitcoin or gold or precious metals or uranium or whatever it is. So I think the military fundamentally changes shape in a sound money world where we can actually re-anchor it to the correct purpose of protect the country, protect the people, protect the resources. That's good. We should do that.
100%. Just a 3 of 5 multi-sig in a platoon of RCR guys.
You could do a 12 of 21. This is the crazy thing. It's programmable money. You could do a 12 of 21 of 21 federation that's required to move a threshold of assets. So you have 20, you have 100 platoons distributed around Canada. You have like 12 key holders in each platoon. You have 21 key holders, 12 of them in the platoon have to come together, broadcast the signal, and 12 platoons across the world have to coordinate to broadcast the signal to move a large amount of funds. Like, you can do whatever you want. They already do this for sensitive codes, like new codes. I feel like if we actually knew how new codes were stewarded, we might be a little bit nervous at how unadvanced it is. But let's just for a second imagine.
Just have a hacksaw and you can you take the football off a guy's arm and
So, but that's how you do it, and you can. That means that the nation's wealth is beyond reach of any politician. That is what.
You run a mini script that's timed for like a 4 year like period, or like an 8 year period.
Time lock it for 21 years.
You can't even touch it. And yeah, it's like, oh, we're worried about what this guy's. Yeah, it's interesting the different dynamics that can play out here. But yeah, we get really good at saving because we're worried about so and so getting in.
Well, and the other thing too is maybe an optimal model. It's a decentralized model. Maybe you should be paying out a portion of your nation's stack to every citizen that has paid, that has contributed in some way, paid quote unquote taxes for 5 years at least. They get a dividend. I was going to say in the mail, but they get a dividend in their wallet on their phone every
In the
month.
mail, it's just a seed phrase, or
Yeah.
it's a receive address QR code in the mail.
Yeah. Fresh UTXO on the main chain. Here you go. There's a lot of implications to think of here. I think it's going to be interesting to see that Bitcoiners will inevitably, the hardcore OG Bitcoiners will be the people at the table in military discussions talking about how you protect a nation's keys. It's going to be, I think of that world. Like I spend time there because it's my antidepressant of when fiat life gets me down, I just go into imagining a
When you just
no-arms
start getting
future.
grumpy,
If I get crusty or if I'm doing too much work, not enough play, I just go for a walk, imagine a Bitcoin future and come back and I'm like different human. So
Well,
I think
it's
military
super,
changes.
yeah. It's interesting. Like, even if you're this kind of like, we need a super strong military, I think libertarians maybe get the rap of having it be like, I want someone with like a 22. Right, like let me have an AR-15, and I want someone with a 22, a platoon of 18-year-olds with a 22 rifle in the government protecting me, because I don't want them to have the power to, seize my assets, to limit my rights, kind of small government. But there's kind of a different side of it, where it's like, even if you're someone who's in for a strong military, it's incredible to think. If your procurement process in your military was on a sound money standard, like you're talking about the difference between a budget of 30,000 for a year, or you are on a sound money standard, that $30,000 in 10 years becomes, I don't even know what it would be. Like you're talking about a completely different, a fundamental change in how you equip your soldiers. And this isn't me, this is just me like thinking about this. But you have some fund that is a bit longer of a time horizon in the military. You're talking about funding, like getting the best kit for your guys. You're talking about getting the best just equipment in general, vehicles. Everything changes with this. And your if you and the incentives are aligned in such a way that you protect your country, you pay these guys, you don't have your Apache shot down with a RPG because you're invading some country you have no business being in. You're going to just get wealthier as a military, and you're going to get better equipment as a military. And if you want to sell your Bitcoin, you want to sell your whatever hard asset we're talking about, you're going to get poorer as a military. So you're disincentivized to invade people for no reason, which I think that no one wants to invade. I think nowadays no one wants to invade people for no reason. The cynicism, the kind of pulling the wool over the eyes since Iraq, and like this has changed. And yeah, there's a lot more to that. Like it's hard to print. You can't just print yourself into a war. You can't print the money into existence in a war. You have to actually ask, and people will say no. No, I'm not going to increase my taxes by 20% so you can fight this bullshit war. There is not a political party in existence that I think would disagree with this idea. I think it's just for everyone. Yeah, it's exciting, Like, please just do this.
To
It's
everyone listening,
fun.
share this with all your friends and family. Yeah, I think Bitcoin makes war unaffordable, basically. That's another trope in Bitcoin, but I think it is actually true when you bite down into it. Can you just give me 1 sec? Someone's knocking at my door and they won't stop. Just gonna pause it for
Oh,
1 sec.
yeah.
All right, we paused recording there for a sec, but we're back. And we were talking about how Bitcoin makes war unaffordable. I think Canada is not really a country that's known for invading other countries. Like we said, we're really a country that's known for exploiting our citizens based on our CRA to military staff ratio. But I think just in general, the game theory globally, geopolitically, is China's not really incentivized to invade Canada and steal our seed phrases because it's really hard to steal them. And so the incentive for war and to go to another country to rob their resources is pretty low. And the idea that you would have to sell a bunch of Bitcoin to go and invade a country in hopes of getting something is just unappealing. So I think it does change the geopolitics of war.
Not to mention cooperation is just deeper. Like you're like we don't have to invade Japan to get a Corolla from them. They just want to sell us a Corolla. You know, it's like things
We're incentivized to trade.
we're trading is better than war. It's just
Yes.
yeah, it's
Also,
like who
war
would
is
have
just a
thought?
fancy war does war is like a tamed down word for mass murder. This is another thing too that people often, I think we're desensitized to the word war, but it's actually a crazy thing that war is just a mass is just murdering people to try and steal something or to settle a disagreement. And it's like that's not how it happens. In nature, wolves are much more aligned to figure out a hierarchy of who is the strongest animal to lead and to work together than they are to kill each other, because then they get very little. The pack is weaker when you kill off the other strong members. So I think in the natural world, where we don't have like missiles, rockets, drones, whatever, nukes, it's like tribes would battle against each other, but you couldn't do it in such a scale with such a high damage ratio that you can now. So we just have to smarten up a little. Okay, so sound money standard changes the military. We talked about how it changes health because it lowers people's time preference, makes healthcare possible, I think, and disincentivizes disease care, which is, I think, what happens in a fiat regime. In a sound money standard, inflation becomes pretty much structurally impossible. And if anything, it becomes low, like actually 1 to 2%, directly tethered to have more assets backing the currency. So, in theory, the actual inflation, the debasement of each unit that's owned becomes obsoleted in a sound money standard because if they create more money, it's only because they have more assets backing that money. And I think the interesting thing to think of is like there has to be some sort of redemption of the backing. And in a world of gold, that's actually pretty tricky, right? Because if you go into the bank with $1,400, it's not like the bank can just give you an exactly $1,400 chunk of gold, right? It's like pretty difficult to actually redeem gold for paper notes in a modern world, and it makes very little sense. But if you went into any bank, say you have 10,000 Canadian dollars, each of those dollars is backed by Bitcoin. You can go into any bank in theory under this regime and say, I would like to redeem Bitcoin for these. I want to trade in these Canadian dollars and I want to receive Bitcoin into my own wallet at whatever market rate applies to the Canadian SAT exchange rate. And the Canadian dollar would preserve its purchasing power because it's not being debased, right? It has to, the supply can be increased, but it has to be based in reality by being tethered to Bitcoin or gold. I don't think, the more I think about it, the more I realize gold is dying a slow death, a slow and certain death. Bitcoin is having an acute, shocking, volatile emergence. So it's like, if we're going to change systems to a sound money system, this is a heavy lift. It's doable and we need to do it, but you don't want to be redoing it every like 10 years, you know? Like we should do this and say, let's do this for the next 100 years. And it doesn't make sense to do it with gold because gold's not going to be around, I don't think, in 100 years in the same capacity as it is right now, because it's going to get demonetized to its utility value. There will be an element of scarcity that prices gold beyond its probably utility as just a metal, but yeah, I think inflation basically ends on a sound money state, and the state can't devalue human time by creating more units of currency, and that would improve price stability. Also, prices aren't always going up, right? The prices would change, but it would be to the downside direction because we're technology is helping us create more things for cheaper. That would materialize directly into the price of things if the currency wasn't devalued. So I think that's a big change that happens when we switch to a sound money standard is inflation ends. Your purchasing power goes up over time. It doesn't decrease over time. And the benefits of that are just way more abundance for everyone. Period.
Yeah, well, I mean, think about people who are, like, let's imagine someone who's, they're working three jobs. They can't spend any time with their kids, and their purchasing power is just being stolen from them year after year. Things are getting harder. And they're being more and more impoverished. They can't afford to buy a house. They can't afford to they can't afford to accrue assets that get them out, that will help them get out of this trap. Sound money standard makes it so that these people get richer. It makes it so that over time, imagine you're working, okay, I'm making $15 an hour. I'm working three jobs. That $15 is able to buy me, like, now it's like half a meal at a restaurant. It's the quality of the food that you can buy is degrading over time as it stands. As things improve in terms of, as things deflate, as the price of goods drops, that person needs to work less and less over time, even though they may not be able to save yet. They can't save their money, but all, like, gradually over the course of, let's say, a year, this person is now able to afford slightly more. They can feed their kids slightly better. They can have kids. They can feed their kids better. They can clothe their kids more and more gradually over the course of years. And eventually they can quit one of their jobs. They can work two jobs. They can work eventually one job. This is the problem. Like, everything that we hate, every argument we have with people, every person you disagree with online, I think I've yet to think of a problem that is not solved by this. And I know I, like, probably preaching to the choir in some case, but I mean, we're trying to educate people who have never been exposed to this. And I think just getting this in our heads that deflation is, it's super important. It can be dangerous in ways that we've described and that Keynesians would describe if it's this huge shock and it can cause problems, but it's this fever that we have to agree as a civilization we must move through, get on a sound money standard as individuals, get on a sound money standard as a country, in order so that this dream of people, like, people are hurting, man. Like, where I live, like, the number of people that wear jeans is diminishing, and it is pajama pants more and more, man. Like, you see them out, they're grocery shopping in their pajama pants, looking sicker, looking sadder, looking, and it's like you can, everyone is feeling this, you know? It's like this gradual demoralization. I think it's, and I know you probably agree, it's like, it's the money. People, like, and the outlook is worse. Their outlook towards the future, you know, this changes. Like, if you have, if you incentivize people to eat cheaper and cheaper foods and they can't afford things, they're working more, they're sleeping less. This is like,
The result is
we were talking
disease,
earlier, like,
clearly.
it's disease. It is, this is a disease. This is the cause of a disease. And on the flip side, when people are getting richer and richer, you don't have, like, your grandparents aren't in despair of their children who are addicted to drugs and their grandchildren who are in this horrible situation. The grandparents can't even support them. Like, I know people personally in this situation. I think everyone listening to this probably knows people. I guarantee people, you have seen someone on the street today in this situation that does not need to be the case. It is the most important problem of our time. It is going to become more and more an important problem every single year. And yeah, it's, yeah, I mean, what else do you say? That's,
I mean, immoral money demoralizes society. I've never actually, like, people being demoralized. It's like literally removing morals from the world by using a money that is void of morals. That's a
corrupting their money. Like,
I'll have to unpack that eventually, because that's all right. I got a few more on my list that we can riff on.
Yeah, please.
Governments can only spend within the bounds of the money they have. They can only, so if you go a layer deeper, it's like every, it's kind of crazy to think about this. Two just truth bombs that I want to drop on people. If the government can create money as much as it wants with no bound or limit, why are they taxing us? I heard Nayib Bukele ask that question. And it's a serious question that I want everyone who's listening to this to just think of and ask and pose that to other people. No one's thought of that. Or I shouldn't say that. Few people think about that. If they can create as much money as they want, why are they taking your money? And it's because taxation is a system of control, not an economic imperative. So that's one thing to think of. And then the other thing I want to say is every dollar that the government spends is stolen from someone. If the money was printed, it was stolen from future generations of unborn Canadians, which is dark to think of. You know, it's either stolen directly with taxes or indirectly with inflation. That's the reality. Every dollar a government spends is stolen, either indirectly or directly. So those two things are just to preface this next point, which is a superficial thing to say with those things in mind. Those are the deeper questions to ask. The superficial one is government, it actually enforces government spending discipline when they have a constraint on the amount of money they can spend. And I think that's a good thing, right? They can't run billions and billions of dollars in deficits, spend money that they don't have. Therefore, de facto, a lot of the waste gets trimmed, which I think is a great thing. It's like not overnight, but as soon as the incentives change, the government has a smaller portion of money. If they're trying to spend way more than that, they're going to have to tax people way more. And people say, well, what are you spending this money on? I don't want to give you four meals worth of my family's money this month to go to farmers in Guatemala to teach them about gender equality. I don't want that.
I wanted to ask you about that because I try to wrap my head around, like, you know, we have this, even if you're this fiat maxi politician that thinks like printing money is great and inflation is good and all these things, like, why?
It's money laundering.
It's just virtue, the cynic in me is like,
it's money laundering. 100%. It's virtue based money. It's a money laundering scam. I think eventually here's the intense piece. I think eventually military tribunals try political treason. Eventually, so much like Canada has literally been for the past decade, 15 years, I would say, has been looted and plundered by bankers and by politicians. Not all of them. I'm not saying every politician did this, which is why there's tribunals and trials that are done. Follow the money. Politicians approve of billions of dollars and hundreds of millions of dollars being spent on things that seem totally unrelated and frivolous. And frankly, even if you consider yourself a good person, you can look at that and say, I'm seeing homeless people everywhere in my city, and we just sent $10 million to a place in Africa I've never heard of to help people with something I don't even agree with. Where is my say in how my money gets spent? Like, what's going on here? And why did that get spent there? And I bet you when these tribunals happen and full financial audits are done with all records and all done publicly, if you served as a public politician, you should be subject to a public trial to basically prove your innocence that the money you approved to be spent on weird, weird things didn't go into your bank account in some way.
And even if you agree with, you know, LGBTQ training in Guatemala, or, you know, what, pick your questionable government expense, even if you agree with these things, there's someone that is being forced to pay for that that disagrees with you. My opinion is that that is immoral. You're stealing money from someone who does not want to buy that thing and can pr probably put that money to good use elsewhere. And I just think, yeah, stealing from, because if you agree with that, that expense, there is going to be some expense that you disagree with that a different politician is going to come in with different political leanings and different cynical kind of ways of laundering this money that you strongly disagree with, and they are going to force you to pay for that thing. And you can just use your imagination to imagine what that is. Like, would you want to be, if you're, if we're imagining that's kind of the liberal example of this like caricature, strange expense that is like that someone on the right would like strongly disagree with.
I like
Imagine
this
on the,
exercise.
imagine you're on the left and you're for climate change, and someone in the government decides to take, to print a bunch of money into existence, take it from your children's children or your children, and fund some like far right group in this in Europe educating people about how Hitler wasn't such a great wasn't such a bad guy, as like a caricature example on the right. You like it's
You wouldn't
yeah,
want
you
to be
don't have to
paid.
go far.
You wouldn't want to be forced to pay for something you strongly disagree with.
It's the same. I mean, there's parallels to free speech. It's the same reason why you got to protect free speech, even if someone's, especially if arguably someone is disagreeing with you, saying some awful crap that you disagree with, because one day it's going to turn around and your speech is going to be curtailed for the reasonable shit that you say, reasonable stuff that you say. So, yeah.
So it enforces sound money standard, enforces government spending discipline. We trim the things that don't matter. And I think there's just a higher transparency expectation. I think the other thing with government spending, if we really want to just follow that thread for a bit, is like if we shift spending locally, this is the solution to ending waste. Because if in your regional district, there's a town hall. There are a certain number of roads, plumbing, policing, blah, 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 blah. All the things that you're on the hook for paying for in your taxes. The money gets sent to the municipality and spent municipally with citizen involvement in saying, well, okay, where are we spending this money and why are we spending it? Oh, John wants to spend money breeding rabbits to have more rabbits. Well, I'm not down with that. Let's all vote. Do you want to breed rabbits with this money? No. Perfect. John, your proposal's out the door. We're going to spend that money on schools or outdoor stuff or whatever. So I think if you push the spending locally, you have this elimination of this distance, which is people living in the capital of Canada, completely disconnected from the rest of Canada, literally spending all the money on things without the consent of all Canadians. If you push spending locally, there will be some national spending, like how much do we spend on our military to protect Canadians, to protect the country, to protect our resources? How much do we spend on, all these things that will exist? But I think like 90% of government spending can be trimmed. That sounds radical, but there is such an incentive to waste when there is no constraint or limit on money creation. It's absurd. It's crazy. And we would just eliminate all, we would instantly change the incentives with the sound money standard, and the incentives will slowly eat away at the waste over time. This isn't this thing where like we change the sound money standard, all waste is gone. The sound money standard, the new incentives chew away at the waste that is constantly happening without constraint in the fiat government. So I think state spending is just reduced in a massive way. The size of government gets much smaller, I think is what I'm trying to say sound money standard.
Yeah, and I also think that there's this interesting inversion that will occur over time. I hadn't thought about it until now, so I might be fumbling with this a bit and I might be wrong, but like you're, you know, okay, we're not going to spend our money on that. People disagree with spending our money on that. The you know, the crotchety people in the town hall saying like, I'm not spending my money on this like strange thing. I think that as the town inevitably gets richer, being on a sound money standard, the crotchety people become more and more w available, willing to spend on things that may be a luxury 5 years ago, but are now something that is easily afforded. It's like, yeah, you know what? Let's make this green space in our town because we're rich and we have the ability to do this. This is like the, I mean, this is just, I think, but it's again, it changes the incentives. All of a sudden, people who would normally be like, you're not taking my money to build this park in the town because we need to
Because you're in survival mode.
pour this. Yeah, you're in, exactly. You're in survival mode. Think about like hierarchy of needs situation. It's like, no, we, why would I, but there's homeless people everywhere. Why are we spending the money on this? Well, eventually those problems get solved over time. It's
Yeah, no
just,
homeless people. Streets are clean. Everyone's happy. Schools are amazing. Everyone's healthy. That's an abundance mindset where it's like, hey, can we build this giant parkour park? It's like, yeah, what other things should we be spending on? That sounds great. There's no homeless people. Life is great. We're all healthy. We have abundant, healthy, nutritious food. People have to work 20 hours a week. I'm not saying that's going to happen overnight, but like that's where we end up when this giant amount of waste is trimmed, when our time is not being stolen, when we're not being taxed as much because we're not allowing the fiat virus to consume all of our money. We will just have so much more. It will be so abundant that the decisions you make, the framework you use to make a decision, goes through the abundance filter instead of the scarcity filter, whereby there's plenty to go around. So if it makes sense and people agree that this is a good idea, and maybe that thing doesn't get done in one community, but it does in another community because people in different communities care about different things. And maybe you gravitate to the community that values that stuff, and that's a good thing. And I think just people reaping more of what they sow is a good thing. Like, it's not even the communists want to reap more for what they sow. Everyone wants to receive more for the energy they put in. Everyone does.
it's absolutely.
I think another thing that happens is banking becomes more stable because fractional reserve banking is very fragile, right? For every $10 in deposits you can lend out 1,000. There's a lot of leverage. There's a lot of excess units that are created based on the small base of collateral. And in a sound money world, the constraint of convertibility demands. So the constraint that at any given time someone can come into the bank and say, here's $10,000 Canadian. I want to convert this to Satoshis at today's market rate. If the bank doesn't have the sats, they go bankrupt. It's like they erupt. The bank goes rupt.
Nice.
And so those banks that are playing silly games will implode. That might lose some people. Like, I think this is what happened during the gold standard. Is like you had runs on banks. Some banks failed that were playing stupid games. Those banks died, and the good banks that were responsible and could meet convertibility demands continued to be banks. And that was basically a way that the market rewarded good behavior. And I think the mega crises are so bad because we've manipulated the banking market. We've manipulated credit and interest rates, and we've screwed things up. We've literally disrupted the natural way of things. And it's kind of like not allowing any small forest fires to happen as the brush accumulates and the debris accumulates. Eventually, a fire happens and it's way worse and way more damaging, takes way longer to recover from because this thing was allowed to fester without being resolved. And when you prop up businesses that don't deserve to be in business because they're shitty at being in business and they would go bankrupt if they weren't bailed out, those businesses die, those resources get recycled into good businesses that do good work. And so I think you get rid of, you make banking more stable, and you get rid of this idea of zombie companies that are crap. Air Canada would be dead if the bank of, if the Canadian government didn't step in and bail out Air Canada. Air Canada would be dead. Guess what? All of Air Canada's planes would be distributed to better companies that offer a better experience for a better price. We would all have cheaper airfares if Air Canada was allowed to die, because that's what should have happened. Air Canada didn't make wise choices. Air Canada dies. That's the consequence of being a company that's not being run effectively or efficiently. And I think a lot of the costs in Canada, like if you've ever flown elsewhere in the world, you realize flights in Canada are pretty expensive. If you ever bought a SIM card anywhere else in the world, you realize SIM cards in Canada are pretty expensive. Why are all these things so expensive? It's because of manipulated incentives where the government screws things up and makes life more expensive for everyone by making arbitrary rules. When all that goes away, this contributes to the abundance. When you have to fly or you need a cell phone, if those things are half price, you got richer in relative terms because things you buy or use are now cheaper. And I think this is just a derivative effect of governments that can't, if you can't print billions of dollars to bail out a crappy company, the company dies, the resources and the assets get distributed amongst better companies, everyone does better. That's something that happens too. And I think people can maybe underestimate how impactful that would be.
Well, yeah, like I like to find little microcosms of what inflation does to really make it concrete. Like if you go to McDonald's, you have to ask for ketchup packages. That is inflation. The reason why you have, they didn't do that before COVID. The government started printing a bunch of money. If you want salt in your bag, if you want ketchup in your bag, you gotta ask. Because they're trying to save it. They're trying to shave off a little bit. If you want to bring a suitcase with enough clothes for your week-long trip to, Edmonton, you got to pay $200 now because they're trying to trim the fat everywhere. And in a sound money standard, that when you have sounder money, because the money that we had before, the fiat money we had 5 years ago was slightly, I would say slightly sounder, that like if it's continually being debased, that you didn't have to pay for a carry-on back, X number of years ago, I forget exactly when. There's just these little hints of abundance everywhere, and kind of going back to the previous point there. If someone's, it's like, no, this is, if someone's saying, no, this is utopian, your municipal government is always going to have this waste. You're going to, the sound money standard isn't going to bring this abundance. This sound money standard is being adopted by people you might know, and it has already done this in their life. This happens on an individual level. You get into this, be it Bitcoin, you start saving and sound money, people's lives improve in the ways that we are describing. This is not theoretical. It is not at the expense of anyone either. That's the thing. You're not printing a bunch of money into existence, devaluing the currency, and then the price of your assets is going up based on that. You're just putting you're taking the money that you earned in fiat and you're putting it into the sound money. And you're running your life on a sound money standard, and your life will gradually improve in the same way that we theorize that we hope the country in on a macro scale can do the same.
Yeah, it is pretty intense to really think of all the things money touches. Even immigration. You know, these are all talking points, political talking points, but I think they actually are topics that, like, why are so many people flooding into Canada? Some of them maybe not very aligned with Canadian culture to some extent, creating friction within Canada, maybe people feeling less safe in their own countries. The interesting thing here is you cannot change one immigration policy, switch to sound money, cut off the ability to create billions and billions of dollars. Most people don't know this. Most people in Canada, I don't think, know this. But right now, if you're an immigrant coming to Canada, you'll actually be paid. The government of Canada will pay you more than the average salary of a Canadian. to be here. That sounds so crazy and dystopian and untrue. And please fact check me. Don't believe anything you believe us. Don't believe anything you hear us say. Verify everything. Yeah. Saying in Bitcoin, don't trust verify. I have receipts. But if you want to stop the flood of people coming into Canada, stop paying people to come here. The only reason we can do that is because you're stealing money from Canadians to pay people to come into Canada and make life harder for all Canadians, make homes more expensive for Canadians, make food more expensive for Canadians, make jobs harder to find for Canadians. That's a crazy weird thing. And it's, you know, I often just try and ask myself, like, why are we doing that? Who made the decision to do that? And what could they possibly have to gain by paying people, complete strangers, to come into Canada and pay them regardless of whether they have a job or contributing taxes? What could possibly justify that? And Elon Musk was on Joe recently, and he basically, this time around, he explained the homeless industrial complex, which I thought was super fascinating. He was talking about how basically homeless people are worth about $1 million a person to these NGOs that are scamming the government, and they're worth nothing if they're dead. So their interest is to keep them barely alive, zombieing down the street, and to not crack down on the dealers, to not fix the problem, because they're worth $1 million as drug zombies, and they're worth $0 if they're dead or if they're healthy. So
that rhymes with our healthcare system as well, I would argue. True. Incentivizing people to be just sick enough to need care and not well enough to be good enough without it.
But I remember I had heard Elon explain this whole immigration thing on a previous, it was either previous Joe Rogan or like one of his little speeches he did when Trump was running. And it was basically, if you can import immigrants into the country that are getting paid to be here, you're importing voters that are going to continue voting for the people in power who are paying them to be here. It's like a closed loop. Pay the people to come, the people vote for those who are paying them to be here. And so on a sound money standard, when you stop the money, when you have to tax citizens explicitly to pay immigrants to come in, it will be extremely unpopular and you won't be able to do it, right? If they say you need to pay 5% more of what you earn every single year so we can pay random strangers to come into Canada, some of which are going to take your jobs, make your life harder, make your houses more expensive, make your insurance more expensive, people will be like, no, I don't want that. Let's not pay other people. Let's take care of the people that are already here. Let's take care of all the homeless people, the drug addicted people, the people who are at food banks. Like, let's take care of them first. When we have enough, maybe we can think about helping other people who are having a hard time. But like, that doesn't make any sense right now. I don't know if it'll make any sense, because it really just seems like a voter fraud program, basically. And so even just things like that, it's like, we cannot talk about immigration policies, just switch to a sound money standard. When the government can't create billions of dollars, they can't pay people to come into Canada, it counterbalances and sort of equalizes the insurance or the immigration problem to some extent, to a big extent, actually, right? Because then people who actually want to come here and contribute and work come here, not people who want to freeload and get paid to be here to do nothing. That's a whack incentive.
And wouldn't you? Like,
I would.
If you're from one of these countries,
of course,
would you not come here and freeload? And that's the thing. And like, we haven't really run, like, we haven't really discussed our backgrounds though, but like, I know what it is like to be paid to do nothing for an extended period of time. This is not a, like, UBI is not what you want in your life. And maybe there are people who are, you know, they're fine with the, not that I eat Cheetos, but like the Cheeto dust and the sleeping until noon and everything. There may be people who are constitutionally okay with that. I think generally speaking, the human being does not like this state of affairs. I think the human being enjoys work, providing value for other people. Meaning and purpose. When you take that away, which I think is when you're incentivizing people to come to Canada and not work, like I was saying before, I would take that. If I lived in like some despotic regime and I wanted to immigrate somewhere free and awesome like Canada, I would take it in a heartbeat, and I don't speak the language, and I'm getting paid a living wage to stay in my home. Like, again, it's an incentives thing. It's nothing against the people. It's just you're injuring them by pretending to do them a favor. And yeah, the incentives are certainly misaligned. Yeah.
So I think a lot of things. I mean, we've been going for 90. We're going to talk about pillars of libertarianism. If you want to go for another 20, I'm down.
I'm down. Yeah, I'm
All
down.
right, let's talk about pillars of. Let's just share our
My
prism
headphones
thoughts.
might die. I'm just gonna find a new pair, but keep going.
Okay. Yeah, I think we'll just do an introduction to libertarianism because, like, Lucas and I are just trying to figure things out as we go. We're not claiming to know any secret information or to know the truth or to tell. We're not trying to tell anyone what to do. We're just trying to essentially unpack and explore concepts related to how we think Canada changes when we upgrade the money to truthful, sound money. And part of that journey is imagining what things change and how they change by making that change in money. But I also think there's sort of a requirement to explore different ways of thinking about governance. And libertarianism is a word I've heard. I don't even know if most people will have heard of libertarianism, but it's basically a political philosophy that doesn't get much press. And I think the Coles notes of everything I found out about it, which is what's going to make me want to explore it a little bit deeper, is that it seems like it's just a simple philosophy of don't hit people. Don't steal their stuff. That's like the entire philosophy of libertarianism. Seems super reasonable to me. It seems very good. And you know, the hit people thing can mean many different things, you know. Using violence against people, injecting people against their will, coercing them to do things they don't want. That's the hit people metaphor. And then stealing their stuff is like inflation is stealing people's time. Taxes, when you really go down to it, because it's not voluntary, is also stealing people's money. So yeah, libertarianism to me, I'd love to hear your take on libertarianism, what you think it is, what you like about it, what do you know about it. I'm going to continue learning about it, but I was just saying that really it just seems like it's don't hit people, don't steal their stuff. And frankly, I think before Bitcoin, libertarianism was like a nice political philosophy, but it was theory. And I think Bitcoin is like libertarianism with an actual application. Bitcoin makes libertarianism possible in actuality, is what I'm trying to say. Before that, it's like you can tell people, don't steal from me. But unless you have something that can't be stolen, you don't really have much power. So what are your thoughts on libertarianism and what, like, I think there's a lot of good stuff there in its simplicity and the non-aggression principle of just don't hit people, don't steal their stuff. I could dig that world.
Yeah.
I would find it hard to believe that someone would try and convince me that it's good to use violence on people unprovoked, and it's good to steal people's stuff. Like, I don't think that's good. So why do people not like libertarianism?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think the main kind of counter argument reservation people have with it is that they say, well, the world is a complicated and dangerous place, and there are emergent, they'll say there's emergent properties that, it's all well and good for me to say, like, you have the right, the classic, your fist has the can be, within an inch of my face, but if you hit me, that's where we draw the line, and the law gets involved, or like there's some retributive right that I have based on libertarianism to fix that. And then people say, like, it's all well and good on a personal individual level, but as you move out from, like, kind of fractally to a greater society, things become more complicated, and you start to need to and have laws, and you need to protect the environment in certain ways. because the incentives are aligned in such a way that if you things get complicated, and this is me more being a devil's advocate than anything, like I would consider myself a libertarianism. There's different kind of species of libertarians as well. Like a minarchist, I guess, is one that I've recently heard that is like limited government. Government's necessary. You know, we talked about needing a military to defend people against like force projection from countries that are, keeping the barbarians away. There's always going to be barbarians. The world is a dangerous place. That's where that comes in. So you need to fund, you need to, arguably, it's like, you need to make it so that you may have to take something from someone in order, like, let's say someone disagrees with having a military. I haven't run this through fully, and there's probably libertarians that would disagree with me. But you may have to take someone's money in order to fund a military to protect the country. You know, I'm kind of agnostic as to whether that needs to be some, like, hardcore libertarians would say you just privatize the military, they're going to do way better and you're going to be able to protect your people with that. I'm kind of agnostic there
Who
as
pays
to
the
whether
private
that.
military, though? Who pays the private military?
So the, and this is it, like the classic, well, we got to, build roads and everything. Well, are people going to contribute to pay roads? There's a it wouldn't be a proper, like, and that's not, it's not a Bitcoin podcast, but we talk about Bitcoin a lot. It wouldn't be a proper Bitcoin podcast without talking about game theory, but
Who's
basically,
gonna pay the roads? That's a great
or
meme.
the prisoner's dilemma, right? It's basically like, okay, if you defect and don't pay into, you don't contribute to building the road in your town, say we're doing the libertarian thing, you defect, you don't pave the road in your town, everyone else who decides to pave the road has to pay more. So they suffer, you get richer, and you get a road. The detractors from libertarianism say that's unfair. You should be forced to pave, to contribute to pay for that road because you're a part of the society, you're using the road, and defecting is this kind of freeloading, right? Again, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, and I'm curious if you do. Like, that's kind of, I guess I'm just approaching it from like what the detractors say about it and things that I don't know how to answer. I don't know the right answer to that. I just have this middling kind of minarchist view where we're going to have to contribute to a military. I don't want to make it so that we have Canadian aircraft carriers in the Strait of Taiwan or whatever. Like, but we got to, like, we're going to put some money towards that. Do I have to steal from Canadians, like, quote unquote, steal tax Canadians to do that? I don't know. I don't actually know what my opinion is there.
I mean, I think there's still laws in a libertarian, in a society that's governed in alignment with libertarian philosophy. Let's put it that way, right? Because when people say, oh, it's in a libertarian society, it's like that can mean a lot of different things. If, for simplicity's sake, if the libertarian values are don't hit people, don't steal their stuff, in a society governed in alignment with libertarian principles built on sound money, which I think enables libertarian philosophy to be applied, I think there's still laws. I think there's still taxes, but I think they're voluntary. And so the onus is on you as the tax collector to prove the value is there for people to pay their taxes. I mean, to a certain extent, right now, you're expected to file a tax return, supposed to be honest and truthful, and you pay the right amount of taxes. It's a super convoluted, silly process that's way more complex than it needs to be, which creates a whole other industry, which is accounting, translation layer, accounting and legal, which I think can largely be obsoleted. It should just be easy for people to pay their taxes. It's like, how much money did you make? You know, I would love, I'll make a bold statement. I would love to pay 10% of what I make per year, and for companies I'm involved with to pay 10% of what they make in profit for the company, in income for me, to cover infrastructure, which I would include as military, like roads, parks, like all these things. All these things that if I drive across Canada or I want to live anywhere in Canada that benefit me, right? And then locally, in my neighborhood, I pay for my local services. I pay into the school board every year, which already there already is that in Canada. I pay in to get the garbage done. Private companies do these things, which makes them competitive, and they remove the garbage. Private companies pave the roads, but I contribute to that locally based on where I am, based on whether or not I'm getting that service. Because if I pay a bunch of money for roads and the roads aren't made, I'm going to find the person who took that money and didn't give me the thing, right? But the idea of just a flat rate tax for all Canadians that covers basic infrastructure that benefits all Canadians. And you could even parse it out. Like the budget would be super simple. 2% of what everyone makes, flat rate, goes to military to protect Canadians and protect Canada. You just try something. It's like, what does that get us? What kind of equipment does that get us? Is that sufficient to protect us? Is that insufficient? Whatever the case may be. And then maybe, this whole idea that we just pay, like when we talk about taxes, I'm gonna research all the different taxes we pay in Canada, because there's dozens of them every day that we pay. I think if you just had a basic 5% infrastructure tax on everything that you bought and a 10% flat rate income tax, that would probably be enough for a great country. I mean, I don't know how that would shake out in actual details, but I bet you that's how much waste there is right now in government, is that any tax, for example, any tax on anything that is labeled carbon tax, climate tax, whatever the lingo is, anything related to you must pay taxes to save the environment is a complete scam. I'm not even making a judgment as to whether or not you think carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is a good or bad thing. That aside, even if you accept that, we can have a discussion about that. Even if you accept that that's true, the idea that in Canada, we are the lowest emitters of that gas, which you can deem good or bad, but even regardless of that, and we pay a giant portion of taxes to go into saving the planet, when China is the largest emitter and they don't pay any carbon taxes. So where it's just the most insane thing ever. And the reason I mentioned that is because if you tax energy, you tax everything else. Because the food you eat took energy to get to you. The car you're driving took energy of a truck to bring it from the factory to you. Everything gets more expensive if you tax energy, if you tax gas, fuel. It taxes everything in the grocery store, it taxes everything you consume. So if we trim all these taxes that shouldn't be there, you shouldn't have to pay tax on a home that you own that you've already bought. Like what do you don't actually own the home if you have to pay it in order to keep it. You're just renting from the government. That's a silly one. But if the government came to you, Lucas, was like, hey, we just want you to pay a flat rate 10% tax to cover infrastructure and 5% on everything, on all the consumer goods you buy, you pay 5%. We use that for local costs, local expenses to make sure that your garbage gets picked up, your streets get paved. There's nice schools, there's nice parks, there's mental health infrastructure so that people having mental health problems can go and get help. There's drug rehab places, like all these basic things that you could probably pay for with that tiny tax. I would be cool with that. And if I was paying my local municipal tax for roads and all my roads were garbage, everyone in my neighborhood would go to town hall and be like, who's supposed to be paving the roads? Where did the money that I spent on roads go to? Because it's not paving roads. There's actual accountability within the local area. Whereas right now, if it's just like this giant pool of funds that are spent by thousands of people that work in the capital and don't know what's going on in the rest of Canada, and they're spending it on random stuff that benefits Canadian at best zero, at worst it's costing Canadians in a lot of different ways. That just wouldn't be, it's like, I think there's a way that is libertarian aligned that allows voluntary taxes that are clearly visibly useful and valuable to individuals' lives, where people would be like, I'm okay with paying that because you're not taking half my stuff. You're taking 10%, and I feel protected and I feel safe in Canada and I drive on nice roads. So I'll keep paying you 10% so long as I get those services. And But just the, I think the delineator there is it coercion or is it voluntary?
Yeah, I think that there's a group of libertarians probably screaming right now about how the, and it wouldn't be a podcast again if we didn't bring up, if we didn't mention the Overton window at least once. So like, there's probably a group of libertarians screaming right now
What do you think they're
about
screaming
how
about?
they're screaming about how there used to not be an income tax. You know, and there was revolutions fought over 3% tax.
Right.
You know, and so like all these things. And now I'm not saying that I disagree with you at all. Like I don't know what the requirement is, what the genuine requirement of a government to tax its citizens on a sound money standard that isn't just constantly impoverishing everyone. I have no idea what that number is. I think that there's maybe some sort of market force that will determine that. I think one market force, especially with you know, the voting with your feet kind of ability with, especially with Bitcoin, you can just take your assets where it's the best. And if someone, and like government is in service of providing the best environment for its citizens. And like what is
Theoretically.
it's the well that is like when you realize that that should be the case, it's so bizarre that because you've just been stolen from for so long and gaslit and everything, that it's so strange to realize that, and that the place that does that the best will just be the place that you will move. And there's going to be further market forces with that, where it's going to be more expensive. You know, like El Salvador is like $1 million to get a passport or whatever. Not that I've checked, but just yeah. And so
El Salvador's
it's
charging $1 million. Canada's paying people 80 grand a year. That says
oh
something.
yeah.
That says
Yeah,
something, bro.
exactly. So
Yuck.
so basically I guess the long story short of that is like there's I think that there's going to be some market force that determines the exact rate. Different countries that adopt this, adopting a sound money standard is going to make your country stronger. It's going to make your citizenry more powerful, able to produce wealth. And we're so lucky to live in a world, in a universe, I guess, where freedom wins. You can imagine it being the case that, you know, communism just crushes the capitalist way of doing things. You know, instead of there just being these warehouses of these price-controlled goods amassing in communist Russia, and they're unable to kind of distribute things. There's so many inefficiencies and everything that the society just starts crumbling, and people are just like dying to get to the West. You could imagine it being the opposite, where this evil, mass murdering political force wins. And we're just so fortunate for that to be the case. I believe that that is the case. The further you move along the spectrum of freedom, that things just get better. That's the libertarian in me. That's the optimist in me that just believes that to be the case from evidence, from just the kind of the theory behind it as well. When we have a free market and you see it in the kind of individual free markets that we produced by going on a Bitcoin standard, on a sound money standard. Yeah, but the yeah, I'm just not super clear practically nuts and bolts on exactly like what does taxation look like? What is I just have faith that that will get sorted out as we move to this truthful, honest, open system.
That's probably a good place to wrap. I think you should just keep imagining what do these things look like under sound money, and then we can riff on them. Like, what is, we talked about the military, what does healthcare look like? That's an area that have spent a lot of time thinking about. You know, what does healthcare look like on a sound money state? What does an actual healthcare system look like? There's a novel idea, because we don't have a healthcare system in Canada. So I think we should talk about that. Maybe we'll talk about that on next time we chat next week. But just think through, go through a list and get to as much as you can of items where it's like, I wonder what this looks like under a sound money standard. I wonder what does, I mean, education, you know, we both have young kids. What does education look like on a sound money standard dominated by free markets, where the 10,000 a year people are spending are giving the government to create institutional schools? What does that look like when each family is given $10,000 per kid to figure out what they want to do with regards to school? What kind of options does the free market present to families who have money to spend on schooling for their children because they're not giving it to the state, right? When it's like, when people are just given the resource, the people themselves individually will spend the money better than some other random person in the government. That's like the fundamental belief that's required to shrink the government and to tax people less and to give people more freedom. The people will make the best decisions for themselves, for their own benefit. And when individuals act out of their benefit and they're not given a tool to get more for themselves at the expense of others, when everything you can get for yourself must be earned fairly with honest money, everyone can make good choices for themselves. And that is the free markets are the path to abundance, and central planning is the path to hell, basically, and scarcity, hell through scarcity. And the irony is, sound money, scarce money, obliterates central planning. It's like, and it creates abundance. Whereas abundant money, which is where some people can create as much money as they want, creates scarcity in everything and leads to hell. And all people need to do is just learn about history. Learn about every other time communism's been tried. Let me know how many good outcomes there's been. I'm open to seeing one.
Yeah, and just realizing that we've lived in a half communist system, you know, being able to control and print money is a communist idea, and every problem that the communists are trying to solve or socialists are trying to solve can be solved better with this with these ideas, I in my opinion.
Agreed.
And it's just like, just drop the rock, give it a try in your own life, and try, and once you realize that it works, try it for your country and try getting it going.
Agreed.
Yeah,
Thanks for
man.
listening, y'all. We'll catch you in the next conversation. If you want to know more, go to CanadianOrangeParty.com. Thanks for your attention. And thanks for spreading the word about sound money and the benefits that come to Canada by switching to a sound money standard. Ciao.